Good morning, Acme Whistles.
Yes, Simon Topman, please. A telephone call to a manufacturer of whistles in Birmingham. Simon Topman?
Yes.
Can you explain to me how you got your name, Acme Whistles?
Way back in 1870, when the company was founded, it was a very popular name. People knew it meant the best, the highest you could reach for. But even more important, it's got a letter A at the front of it.
Right.
A, you're adorable. B, you're so beautiful. C, you're a cutie full of charm.
And obviously in the 1870s predates telephone directories, doesn't it? So this must have been just ordinary trade directories, was it, that your ancestors were going for?
That's absolutely right. So when you wanted to see your name in the ironmonger's trade directory for whistles, or in the haberdasher's directory, whatever it was, Acme got you up there at the top, the first name they saw. So hopefully you were the first one that got the inquiry.
And next time I need a whistle, I will know where the acme of perfection in that line of merchandise lies.
Give me a call, we'll sort you out.
I'll do that. Thank you, Simon. And what we'll be trying to sort out is the role order, in its widest sense, plays in language. The way we'll order our programme will be to start simply and end, well, shall we say, challengingly. And to help in that enterprise, I'm joined by the distinguished writer, one of my absolute favourites, David Sedaris, who's known, as we'll hear, for his orderliness. And that extends beyond the crystal clarity of your prose to your personal life, which has formed the raw material of much of your writing for about 40 years, David.
Mm-hmm. When I was young, because we had six children in my family, and I would come home from school and I would start cleaning the house. And I would vacuum, and my sisters would leave their coats on the table, and I'd take their coats and throw the coats in their room. And one day I realized that it was a losing battle because I was the only one in my family who cared, right? Yeah. So then I thought, well, okay, I can at least keep my room clean. Yeah. And my room was really clean. When we moved to where we are in Sussex, I was just appalled by the amount of litter on the sides of the road.
Just and, thrown out by drivers and that sort of thing.
Yeah. And so I just started doing what I could to maintain. So I have about, I don't know, 25 miles of roadside that I maintain. And I usually walk between 18 and 22 miles a day.
We know this because, of course, you wrote a very famous essay about your love affair with the Fitbit, one of those activity watches that are now so prevalent, but a new discovery for you. And do you still use that as well so you can combine two obsessions, counting now, of course, a different kind of well-known Californian computer company watch. I see you're showing me.
And a Fitbit.
This is fantastic. So are you the sort of person who won't say you're OCD because it's not in alphabetical order? It should be ODC. I mean DCO. I mean CDO. That's it.
Listen, I know we were laughing there, but apologies. We're not making fun of OCD. I know how serious a condition it is. I know people for whom it blights their life, and we're not making fun. But our programme is all about order and disorder, and David is a willing subject. And our running order, of course, should start with that simplest of orders, alphabetical. But where does alphabetical order begin? We know lots about the history. We know that its origins were in Egypt some 4,000 years ago, that its root is the Amu people, who were migrant workers in Egypt, and that the alphabet itself, more or less in the form that we know it, spread via the Phoenicians to ancient Greece. And now nearly three-quarters of the world uses a form of alphabetic writing. Do we know why, though, the alphabet is in the order that it is? No. We don't. Yet this mysterious and some would say arbitrary ordering system might affect your very life chances.
We have discovered evidence to suggest that people whose surnames put them towards the end of the alphabet have less satisfactory experiences in school and less satisfactory initial experiences when they join the workplace.
That's a professor of economics at the University of Colorado in Boulder, who rejoices or perhaps laments in the name Jeffrey Zachs. Now, it's worth remembering that alphabetical order, once a primary way of organising everything from a class of infants to the contents of a national library, is less significant in the digital age.
Nevertheless, that alphabetically ordered roll call or register taking is significant.
Okay, a bit of order, please. Let's do this. Okay, Andrews, a Baker.
What we imagine happens frequently is that that roll call occurs in alphabetical order, starting with those at the front of the alphabet.
Fry, no?
When it begins, people are paying attention. As it proceeds, first, the people who are already called, they no longer have any need to take the thing seriously. And the people who are waiting to be called, their attention's wandering as well. And so as you make your way through the roll call, somehow the intensity of the engagement diminishes.
M-N-O-P, I could go on.
The A's have an opportunity for engagement that is exhausted by the time you get to the T's and the W's.
Speaking, you're okay. We love you. You
may... And it is, or rather was, found to be true using a huge study of people in the state of Wisconsin who graduated from high school in 1957 that your name could affect your fate.
To tell you what you mean to me, we really love you.
Those who were later in the alphabet were less likely to be recognized by their high school teachers as outstanding students. They were less likely to have enjoyed their high school courses, graduate from college if they applied. They were more likely to drop out. They had first jobs in occupations that paid less. They were more likely to go to the military, and they were more likely to have jobs whose prestige was lower.
Such was the size of the sample, which had to be all male, because at the time, most women changed their names on marriage. Dr. Zaks and his colleague, Alexander Colley, were able to filter out other factors.
These effects are most powerful for people who are not distinguished in other ways. So if you're concerned that you're alphabetically disadvantaged, the first thing to do is simply make yourself known in some other way. Take a position, stand out, be someone that the teacher will recognize despite the fact that your last name begins with a W.
Dr. Jeffrey Zaks. So, David Sedaris with an S. Were you aware of where your name comes alphabetically from an early age?
I was, and I was grateful for it, you know, because, you know, on the first day of class when the teacher wanted you to stand up and say a few things about yourself,
yes,
you would listen to the A's and B's and C's and think, oh, that didn't sound good.
So you had time to prepare. And, for example, books. You go into a bookshop, you might start at A, and it takes a long time to get to Sedaris. Do you want to go move them and put them, distribute them evenly?
No, I learned that a long time ago, never to look for your book in a bookstore.
No.
Oh, my goodness, ever. I had a book called once Dress Your Family in Corduroy and Denim,
yes,
and my sister found it in the sewing department. But if you look for your book, you know, when it's not there, or they have more books by Alice Siebold, you know, than you have by you, or it's just going to, I don't know, it's just better for me not to know.
There's someone called Stephen Frey who writes thrillers, F-R-E-Y, or maybe even pronounced Fry for all I know, which is very dispiriting. There are usually more of his on the shelf than mine.
But putting aside our ignorance about why humans decided to order the alphabet in the way it is, the concept of alphabetical order is as easy as, as easy as ABC. But there are other linguistic orders that we obey without ever having to learn them at all. Here's a story about J.R.R. Tolkien.
So J.R.R. Tolkien, when he was a little boy, he wrote a story and he showed it to his mother. And the story was about a green great dragon. And his mother said, you can't have a green great dragon, it has to be a great green dragon. And Tolkien was so upset he didn't write another story for years and years.
This is writer Mark Forsyth, whose book The Elements of Eloquence goes into detail about why that dragon had to be great, then green.
And the reason that it has to be a great green dragon is that in English, adjectives absolutely have to go in one particular order, and that order is opinion, size, age, shape, colour, origin, material, purpose, noun. So you can have a lovely little old rectangular green French silver whittling knife, but if you mess around with that order in the slightest, you'll sound very, very weird. You can have a good little thing, you can't have a little good thing. If I say I've got a French good interesting meal, then you'd say, what? If I've got a leather green chair, it should be a green leather chair. There's one in the corner over there. As with so much in language, in your native language, it all just runs on that very back of your brain. Nobody's ever has to teach an English speaker, a native English speaker, this form of orderliness. It's not an order that we've been ordered to learn. We've just learnt it.
We must dig deep to find the reason that adjectives have to be in this order. So we've got a psycholinguist to help.
I'm Krista Sandroy. I'm an associate professor at University College London at the linguistics department. I work on linguistics and psycholinguistics.
I think we'd better start with some basics about syntax.
Syntax is the technical term for word order or the order of words in sentences. There is, of course, what we call linear order, which is very simple. The words just come one after the other, and that has an effect on what the sentence might mean. So if you take a sentence like, the dog chased the cat, it means something completely different from the cat chased the dog. And you know that because the order of the nouns and the verbs tells you who's the chaser and who is being chased.
But let's now try and chase another kind of order, hierarchical order, the kind which nearly put paid to J.R.R. Tolkien's career. Krista has proposed a sample string of adjectives topped off by a noun. Numerous, beautiful, big, round, wide, Cretan pots.
Found, let's say, on a sunken ship or something like that. You know, every English speaker would be perfectly able to understand this, right? So you're able to compute the meaning of the whole colourful big noun phrase from the meaning of the various adjectives, and you can combine those, and you have an image in front of you of these objects. But the order of the adjectives was predetermined by their meaning, actually.
And it seems the rule of thumb in English is that adjectives that have the greatest objective weight earn their place close to the noun they describe, whereas airy-fairy adjectives that are subjective or less precise, like delightful or horrid, must be satisfied with a place in the phrase further away from the noun. So our pots, what was the phrase?
Numerous, beautiful, big, round, wide, Cretan pots.
Thank you. Well, numerous is a bit imprecise. Beautiful is judgment. Big, round and wide are estimations, albeit explicit ones, but the solid, single, unchangeable adjectival truth about these pots is their origin. They are Cretan. And if they were observably green, they would be green Cretan pots, their greenness being slightly more extrinsic than their intrinsic Cretanness, because you could paint them another colour. You couldn't stop them from being Cretan. The order has to be extrinsic to intrinsic. Pretty much. The main thing, as pointed out by Mark Forsyth earlier, is that no teacher stood at the front of a class and taught you this quite hard-to-grasp rule of order. You learned this complex theory about order by using it and hearing it used. Orderliness is intrinsic, isn't it? Here it starts to become a bit fearsome.
Who's afraid of the big bad wolf? Big bad wolf, big bad wolf. Who's afraid of the big bad wolf? Fa la 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 la.
And after all that hard work, here comes the wolf. And he huffs and puffs and blows our theory down. This wolf, according to Dr. Sendroy's rule, is intrinsically, observably big. Nothing we can say about this wolf can change that. But the wolf's badness is a matter of human judgment. According to what we've just concluded about adjectival order, the big bad wolf should really be the bad big wolf. Well, to find out why that sounds wrong, we have to look at another hierarchy of order in language. Mark Forsyth.
Another aspect of order is a thing called ablaut reduplication. You hear the pitter-patter of tiny feet or the ding-dong of a bell, but you never hear the dong-ding or the patter-pitter of tiny feet. It's got to be bish-bosh-bash. It's I-O-A. So it's tick-tock. It's not tock-tick. Now, that ablaut reduplication you find in all sorts of languages. You find it across the world. You find it in Japanese, even.
So, ping-pong, not pong-ping. Whew, good shot. Like the reason for alphabetical order, the reason we feel we have to follow this kind of order of vowel sounds has been lost to us. These orders are pretty much intrinsic to our language. There's even a hierarchy of orderliness that says that this ablaut or vowel order can cancel out adjectival order. Yet these rules are imposed without a ruler. Unlike those silly so-called rules imposed by well-meaning enthusiasts about not ending a sentence with a preposition, for example, up with which it's very difficult to put, Mark Forsyth will now demolish that rule.
It's such stuff as dreams are made on, as Shakespeare put it. It's one of the errors that flesh is heir to. You can always end a sentence with a preposition. Shakespeare did all the time. King James Bible does it all the time. If you just try to use any phrasal verb in the imperative, you'd end up saying, outlook, down get, off bugger. In the imperative, if you are using a phrasal verb like get out, shut up, then you obviously have to end the sentence with a preposition.
Stand down, Mark Forsyth. But don't go away. Is the imperative mood and the giving of orders part of our wider investigation into order and language? I'd say yes.
No! No! Obviously.
Listen up. Come along. No, they are. Yes, yes, they are connected. They are quieted down. Order! Where's that whistle? Thank you. Now, the imperative mood is the ordering of behaviour using language, and that is intrinsic to a great deal of what language does. It orders behaviour as well as ordering thought. So the imperative has usually been correctly signalled by the exclamation mark, although exclamation marks now sometimes seem to signal a rather irritating artificial gushing of emotion, of which I'm as guilty as the next person.
Dear Mark! How are you? It drives me mad. Whoa, look at me, I'm so excited. Ah! It's rather like, you know, when somebody sends you an email all in capital letters and it sounds like they're shouting.
David Sedaris?
So I might use them if someone's yelling.
Yeah, so it's in part of speech.
But I tend to use them more when I'm making fun of someone.
Right. David, if I want to mock my mother, I will email her these days rather than postcard or letter, and I'll sprinkle it with exclamation marks because she is the most luxuriant user of exclamation marks. And, of course, since the age of Twitter and text, they've proliferated.
But I'm with you. Like, you get emails and you think, oh, my God, I didn't know you were that person. But now they seem downright sophisticated. Next to emojis.
Oh, yes, exactly. They do, don't they? That's very well put.
You know, it's interesting. I remember a woman at my church in North Carolina self-published a book about her family. And this was probably 1982, before a lot of people were self-publishing. And my mother bought the book and said, oh, it's so good. I've been reading it. And I opened the book and I said, it's not a real book. There are too many exclamation marks in it.
For this very reason, a professional writer, Nikki Waller, decided to deny herself use of the exclamation mark altogether, to ban it from her writing. Ms. Waller is a senior editor of the Wall Street Journal, a person whose job it is to lead, if not order.
As a boss, I would never use an exclamation point to give someone an order. That's yelling at them. We do not shout much during a normal day at the Wall Street Journal.
But as we've heard, this formerly shouty item of punctuation has morphed into a softener.
I would often catch myself softening my emails with exclamation points, knowing that women managers can be seen as quite harsh or too aggressive if they don't soften. I wanted to just be myself and be quite straightforward about what I thought. Other people gave it up with me as well. And so we kind of traded notes during this, what we called our exclamation point fast, which was great because it happened during the Jewish holidays as well in a time of fasting. So it was kind of in theme for the month of September. And instantly, other women they worked for, the recipients of these emails would get back to them and say, like, are you mad at me? Did I do something wrong? And this was in response to notes with praise. They just didn't end with exclamation points.
So Nikki Waller and her colleagues entered into an act of self-discipline.
In principle, I think all writing is about orderliness. the modern workplace, so much of what we count as daily work is just volleying emails back and forth. And, you know, I'd say that the number one thing about email when you sit down to it is to know what it is that you want to say before you start saying it.
Which brings us neatly on to the last and possibly most important item in our orderly program. Is language the ordering of thought? If thought, to use a sloppy simile, is a bit like scrambled egg, swilling formlessly about in the more distant recesses of the brain, then how do we explain its refinement into what I am doing now, making it the stuff of thought, as Steven Pinker described it? Krista Sendroy again.
So the idea would be that we have to have a part of our thinking, not necessarily everything, so there might very well be a bit of scrambled egg at the back, but there must be some part of our thinking which is capable of holding on to what we call concepts, you know, categories, ideas, very, very specific units, and kind of put them together according to certain rules. And this is what we call symbol manipulation. We have symbols and we manipulate them. We use combinatorial rules to put them together.
It's almost as if in one part of your thinking, there is an infinite keyboard, not just featuring the alphabet, but also a vast number of symbols betokening ideas, concepts, feelings.
That's right. The order in which you press the symbols will actually combine the meaning of the symbols that you used. And basically meaning emerges as a combination of the meaning of the symbols themselves and of the rules or the order in which you put them together. So that's why people think of this as the language of thought. Simply the idea being that at least part of our thinking, part of our higher order cognitive thinking, is rule ordered and symbol manipulating in this particular way.
And the theory is called the language of thought hypothesis.
But of course, it is just a hypothesis. It was never meant to encompass all of our thinking. So, you know, I don't think that Jerry Fodor, who proposed this hypothesis, ever thought, for instance, that art or religious, spiritual, or parts of dreams or any kind of visual memory would be part of this. You know, we should not think of this as something that makes thought processes necessarily rigid and deterministic.
Other hypotheses are available. But ask yourself, and forgive me if this sounds like ordering you about, ask yourself, if you'd be kind enough, and we'll pause for a moment to do this. Reach back and ask yourself if you can work out what's in the back of your mind before it gets ordered by the infinite language of thought keyboard that we've talked about at the front. And we've asked writer David Sedaris the same question.
Gosh, I mean, I think you need language in order to articulate it.
The artist Paul Klee said a thing that I liked quite a lot. It's very neat. Was when asked how he constructed a painting or picture, he said, "I take a line for a walk." And I think it's true as a writer. You can take a line for a walk and just see where it takes you. Yeah.
But if it's just a thought in your brain, I don't know, it's like a tree falling in the forest, right?
It sort of is, isn't it?
Or you need Paul Klee's pen, you know,
yes,
to articulate it.
It's far be it for me to try and play an armchair psychologist or psychiatrist, but do you think there is an element in the way you write that is ordering the world in a similar way?
At least in my diary writing, I am. I started keeping a diary when I was 20. I was still living in North Carolina then, but I did it the first day, and then I did it the next day at exactly the same time, and the next day at exactly the same time. I never had to force myself to go to my desk because at that moment in my life, everything was done. You know, if I didn't do my laundry at 7 o'clock on Sunday, the earth would spin off its axis. I mean, it was just out of the question for me not to do my laundry at 7 o'clock on Sunday. It was out of the question for me not to clean my apartment when A Prairie Home Companion came on Saturday night. So everything was super strictly ordered, which makes it really hard to have friends.
Yes.
Because my schedule always came first. And I have to say, I'm looser than I was.
Yeah, All the same, I suspect David Sedaris's fastidiousness in life does somehow extend to his fastidiousness in his work. The apparent effortlessness of his prose masks the fact that he edits and re-edits, orders and reorders. Does that mean orderliness of character or personality has a bearing in orderliness in thought? And taking that a step forward, does it affect the way we communicate? Krista Sendroy.
I would personally find it very difficult to imagine that orderliness of character can be linked to excellence in language in a direct way. Order in language is implicit, it's tacit, it's something that you're unaware of, something that's just part of the way the brain organizes language, as it were. All of us are orderly in our brains, at least in the language faculty, there is quite a good order. Whereas, you know, other parts of our personality might be orderly or not, and I don't think there's a direct link there.
But what about those rare people, people with the scrambliest of eggs, but at the same time the greatest dexterity with that inner keyboard? Are they likely to be extra effective language users?
I would agree with that. I think having a good language faculty gave humans the ability to bring out the scrambled egg part of the brain in a way that can be shared between humans in really fascinating ways.
Yet the quest to determine how thought is ordered to become language is impossible. It's using language to describe where language might come from. It's like biting your own teeth. So there's no conclusion we can come to. And worryingly, you can flip the whole shebang. Which comes first, thought or word? I'm rather fond of saying, how do I know what I think until I've heard what I've got to say? To paraphrase, I think it was, the novelist E.M. Forster. Anyway, neat endings are for novelists rather than chroniclers of fact, aren't they, David Sedaris?
I mean, it's different when you're writing about your real life, right? Because
you know the actual incidents that you're going to cover, yes.
But then where do you stop that story about your real life, right? Like there was something that I'd been working on about the beach house that I have in North Carolina, and it just didn't have an ending. Well, hurricane came, destroyed the house. Thank you, nature.
Yes.
Thank you for that nice ending.
And thank you, David Sedaris, for helping me wander through this delightfully complex subject and find some order in it. Not at all as easy as ABC.
To tell you what you mean to me.